This is Advent 2, following our procedure of working 10 days in advance and not just 3 or 4. And we unfortunately skip over Advent 1 and land in Advent 2 right off the bat. That this is kind of a nice text to pair with Advent 1, at least let me make a brief comment on the text for this coming Sunday, which is Isaiah 2, 2-4. Which also deals in many ways with the same theme of the eschatological age as an age of peace. That's the swords into plowshares passage, okay? And one that could benefit from our working through it, but that's a different Sunday, unfortunately. I just make this one point on that passage, that for all of the hoop-de-hoo over swords into plowshares, a passage which, as you may know, is inscribed on the United Nations building in New York, what it's really talking about are the nations going up to Zion to hear the Devar Yahweh go forth from Jerusalem. Then, it says, he will judge and arbitrate between the nations. The same two verbs you get here in chapter 11, Shaphat and Yachak, he will judge and render decisions from the nations, and then they beat their swords into plowshares. And the concept of going up to Zion to listen to the word of the Lord is what has to precede beating swords into plowshares, and I've never been real convinced that the United Nations is terribly interested in that. So it's kind of a good case where you can pull a text out of its context and make it into something it's not. By the way, the swords into plowshares passage also occurs in the book of Joel, but with the reverse image. There, they're beating plowshares into swords for kind of the great eschatological battle that is to be fought. That's a passage that you will not see quoted on the United Nations one. So pick your passages carefully. We're in Isaiah 11, and it's pretty much more the same theme. In fact, almost all of these Isaiahic texts, I'm doing the course in Isaiah 1 to 39 this quarter. I made the quip right off the bat that you go into Isaiah in Series A, you go into Isaiah in Advent 1, and I don't think you come up for air until about Epiphany 2 or 3. So it's a good chance to get yourself into the world of Isaiah. And here we have pretty much the same motif of this great eschatological age. But here it's linked not so much to the place that is going up to Zion, which is the point of Advent 1, I think, as much as it is to the person. All right, who is this on which we focus? And here we have kind of the ultimate son of the Davidic line raised up as the great messianic king. Chapter 11, then, verse 1. V'yetza koder me'geza yishai. And yatza, at least you know. The rest of these words you don't. And a shoot, a koder, is kind of a green twig, will go forth from this stump. That's the word for stump, geza of Jesse. Now, let me make a comment right away. A couple of things are striking here. First of all, this is like new growth. Secondly, it's a stump. Now, the only way you get a stump is to have the tree cut down. So this sort of presupposes the cutting off of the Davidic line, first of all. And secondly, it's always, I don't know how hard to push this, but it's always struck me as interesting that it's the stump of Jesse, not the stump of David. That is to say, what we're talking about here kind of goes back to the very root of the Davidic line and starts over from the beginning. It's a radically different David. That is to say, it's not just another Davidic king like Ahaz was to Jotham or Hezekiah was to Ahaz or Manasseh was after Hezekiah, but we have a new David. Because it comes from Jesse, you see. It's not just another David. And a netzer, a branch, a shoot, This is the root of the town name Nazareth, by the way, which was a little burg that meant branch. And it's probably part of that whole pun and joke, you know, about they shall call him a Nazarene. And a nacer from the root stuff, again, root stock. This is not the stump as much as the stuff underground, which is kind of collectively roots. And a branch from his roots will para, bear fruit. You know the noun peri means fruit. This is the verb para, to bear fruit. And naka alau ruach Yahweh. Naka, parse it. It's actually kal, perfect, third, feminine, because the subject is ruach. And the spirit of Yahweh will nuach allow upon him. And now you have these three pairs describing the ruach Yahweh. A ruach of chokmah and binah, of wisdom and discernment. A ruach of eitzah and givurah, of eitzah means counsel, good advice. And givurah means strength. A gabor is a macho guy, kind of a Rambo war hero type. A ruach of da'ath and yirath Yahweh, of the knowledge and the fearing of Yahweh. Fear in the sense, I think, of knowing and honoring Yahweh as God. These are the so-called sevenfold gifts of the Spirit. Unfortunately, there's only six here. I've never quite understood that. Three pair. Though if you take just the over title of Ruach Yahweh, I guess you could do it. Now you get to verse 3a, and you've got a very tough line here. And ha-richo be-yirath Yahweh. And his... I don't know what this word is. I don't think anybody does. If you want to look at it, ha-richo looks like the... It could be a noun. It's got an object, a suffix on it. Oh, his something or another. As you know from this passage, here's one you know in English, they usually translate this something like his delight. His delight is in the knowledge or in the fear of Yahweh. And this is based on the assumption that this word is from the word rich, which no cognate intended means to smell, and comes from the sacrificial texts of a sweet-smelling savor to Yahweh, that the sacrifices went up to God and smelled good to him. The smell of the smoke and the incense of the sacrifice is all in the background here. So that this is something that, so his delight, his personal pleasure with the way things are, even the way things smell, as a sacrifice, will be focused on the fear of Yahweh. I think that's kind of an extended paraphrase of what most English translations are trying to do with a fairly odd form. Now, here's my suggestion. I think this is the hifil, infinitive construct of ruach, which doesn't occur as a verb. This benefits only from being creative. That Isaiah's kind of making up a word here, and he's punning on the concept of ruach. Now, if you made up a verb on ruach, it would be something like to inspire in the hifil, to cause to be spirited, you see, to cause to be filled with ruach. That this is related to the smell word is probably true. I don't want to be insensitive here, but there's often a natural relationship between wind and smell, and that may actually be in the way the word was used. I don't know. So I'm going to. And the second question is the first being what form is this? The second is the suffix objective subjective genitive. Is it his inspiring or is it someone inspiring him? Since the emphasis is on the Ruach Yahweh coming upon this root of Jesse, or this new guy, I'm going to suggest that it's an objective genitive. And he will, quote, inspire him. in the fear of Yahweh. Now, if I'm right, this makes, if you add, by the way, here's another introductory aside. The pericope goes through verse 10. You really got to work with the whole chapter sooner or later because the whole chapter's a piece. And there's seven uses of the word ruach in this chapter, this being one of them. And I think that's helpful. Well, we got to go on. Now, what about him? And not according to the mar'eh of his eyes, yishpot, will he judge. And mar'eh from ra'ah, what is seen is a sight or appearance. And not according to what is heard, mishma from shema, of his ozens, of his ears, will he yakach in the hifil. Yakach in the hifil means to make a right decision, to arbitrate between parties who otherwise can't reconcile. Okay. And he will judge bitzedek in righteousness, the dalim, poor guys. And he will, again, note the use of shafat and yakach. These are the same two verbs you have in Isaiah 2, where he will judge between the nations and decide for many peoples. And he will arbitrate in mishor, in rightness, in equity for the poor of the land. I think the poor of the land has to match the poor at the beginning, so it's the poor of the land on both sides of the bicolon here. And he will strike the earth with the shavet of his pay, with the rod of his mouth. Now, this is obviously a figure of speech. But it's matched by the ruach of his lips. You see, the wind of his lips, both of which are sort of figures for God's word of law and gospel, to use our jargon, you know, God's word of powerful judgment and salvation. He will yamith the rasha, yamith the hifil of muth, cause to die or kill a wicked guy, a rasha. Now, what does it mean that he will strike the earth? This could mean literally that this has to do with the destruction of the earth, which is wicked. It could be that this is a construct chain with the last word of the line, which in poetry is not uncommon. In other words, that Eretz goes with Rasha, and in both halves of the bicolon, it means the wicked guy of the earth, whoever that is. And we can't belabor the point. Five. And Tzedek will be the azor of his matans. These are your midsection. Usually translated, the old King James here has, I think, girdle of his loins, which doesn't mean anything to anyone today. First of all, if people even know what a girdle is, they're not thinking of this. All right, this is our word for this is belt, or really cincture would be the liturgical word. Of his, what you wear around your waist, and emunah, faithfulness, you got to use the hayah second time now, will be the cincture or the belt or the rope that holds your, not pants in that culture, but kind of robe up, of his waist. Chalitz is again your waist. End of this little paragraph, okay? First we got the guy, who he is, that he'll be sort of inspired by the Ruach Yahweh. Now what does he do? He, like all good kings, is supposed to rule in Tzedek and Mishpat and do everything right, except this guy will actually do it, unlike all the other Davidic kings. Verse 6 now changes the image to the natural world. Okay, and Ger from Gur, and a za'ev, a wolf, will ger, literally sojourn, with a kevis, a lamb. And now the vocabulary is just brutal here because these are all animals you didn't learn in Hebrew 1. And a ne'mar, that's a leopard, with a gedi as a kid, a small goat, will rabatz. Rabatz means to lie out in the field with that contented look that cows have. Okay? That's what ravatz means. And an eagle, a calf, and a kafir is a young lion. They have about three or four different words for lions of various kinds. And a yearling, I suspect that's a good yearling, but the point of all of this is obvious, right? We have sort of domesticated and wild animals working it out, all right? We're not working it out. What's the point here? Well, I mean, what's the theological? When did this happen this way? This is paradise restored. This is kind of Genesis 2 before Genesis 3. That's the whole point. Together, yachdav, and a na'ar katon, and a young na'ar, right? A young lad, nohag, this means to lead, usually animals. Bam is the direct object. We'll lead them. 7, a female bull, a cow, and a dove. Dove means bear, not dove. And a bear will ra'ah together, graze. That's another word for graze. Yachdav, together they will rabatz again, lie down in the field with a happy look on their face. The subject is Yal Dehan, their yelids. Here, yelid referring to a child of the animals, their offspring or young, their kids. So we have cow and bear will graze together, their young will lie down in the field in green pastures. And an aryeh, that's another kind of lion, usually the adult and more ferocious kind. Like a bakar. Bakar, you may know, this is the general word for cattle or large herded animals, will eat tevin straw. By the way, Afton Senior High School, which is a few blocks from our house, has as their holiday, you can't say Christmas display, a bunch of animals together, the wolf and the bear and the lion and the sheep and the cow, and I'm sure this is kind of like the United Nations putting swords into plowshares. They just thought this was a nice picture of peace, and I've never had the heart to tell them that it's thoroughly biblical, if not eschatological. There the two kingdoms have been nicely blurred. Verse 8, and Shisha. Here's a nice verb form. You ever want to parse one? I'm not even sure. The root was probably sha'ah, geminate root. This looks like one of these pill pails, they call them, where you got only two root letters, so you got to do something with it. So they double them both, and it looks like you got four root letters. Well, there's really only two. Shisha means to dink around, kind of fool around, doodle. A yonek, yanak is the word to suck, so a yonek is a sucker, literally, here referring to a suckling child. All right, we don't have that word in English. In German does, they call an unweaned child literally a sucker. I forget what, a zeuger or something like that. And a suckling will dink around upon this is the hole, a core of a pethin. Again, vocabulary that's difficult. This is the hole of some kind of poisonous snake, usually translated cobra. And upon the den of a tsifoni, of a viper, another poisonous snake, generally translated as viper, a gamul, cow passive participle of the verb to wean. So this is the parallel to a sucking child, a weaned child. Will put his yad, his hand he will put. 9, not will they do damn, be evil. The hifil of ra'ah means to do something evil. Not will they shakat, destroy, in all the har kodshi, in all the mount of my holiness. Now here, let me pause for a brief reflection. This can certainly be defended as noun and adjective. And you'll find it translated in all my holy mountain. Hebrew prefers to use not noun and adjective, but two nouns. And I would submit that the literal translation is theologically better nuanced. Do you hear the difference between my holy mountain and the mountain of my holiness? in Hebrew, the emphasis is not on the mountain sort of being holy, but it being the place where you find God's holiness. That's the emphasis, see? That's so thoroughly Lutheran, and it's got to be right. But note, I mean, this is the whole place. Where, what are we talking about here? See? Is this the United Nations? Is this all hopes for world peace? Is this the next great world leader to come along? No, this is talking about what's going to happen on the place where Yahweh's holiness is to be located. Now, I mean, where does God's holiness finally get located in space and time and on earth? But the incarnation itself, you see. Because Mala'a Ha'aretz, the earth will be full of the Da'ath Yahweh, you know, the direct object, with Dea, which is really a noun, with the knowing Yahweh, like waters over the sea cover, like waters covering the sea. And it will be Bayom Hahu, major theme here in Isaiah. It will be on that day that the Shoresh, now there's another, did we have that up top? Yeah, that's in verse 1, that the root of Jesse, which is standing to be an ensign of the peoples. Now, we don't have time to unpack all of this. It's not even clear which phrase and clause goes with what here. It will be on that day the root of Jesse, which is standing for an ensign of peoples, to him. That's the root of Jesse, who is standing as a nace is a banner. All right, ensign is it's the flag of the emperor. To him the goyim will seek. Ah, now we've got the nations coming not to Zion, but to the root of Jesse, who seems to be equated with Zion as the place where God causes his holiness to be. And his minukah, his resting place, will be kavod, glory, always translated as an adjective, but in fact is the noun glory. And his resting place will be kavod. And I think now you're connected up to chapter 6, where the kavod Yahweh is filling all the earth. We got to quit, Jeff. I'm sorry. This was a long passage. And that's all we can do for now. Yikes.